Okay, so basically, I found it very interesting. I've been looking at my 12-year-old sister-in-law has a little girl's Bible, which is such an American piece of shit. I can't begin to tell you. It's like this. So I thought
the cartoon is like the comic book one.
No, it's no, it's worse than that. So it says, like, New Living Version, right? So it's like this, like, translation that's been kind of dumbed down. And it's like, okay, so at first that's why I picked it up. I was just curious, like, was it saying, like, OMG, I'm on a cross? Or, like, what is it saying?
Oh, my God.
So, you know, oh, I'm trying to figure out exactly, like, how bad it is. But the translation was like, okay, it's just kind of using, like, you know, much simpler terminology and stuff, and much sort of friendlier phrasing. But it's interspersed throughout with completely, like, something you'd find in a girl's, like, magazine. Like, you know, here's a story about Sally who, you know, she had to work on her math test and it was really hard, and you know, maybe she cheated on her test, and what should she have done? And then it says, read this Bible verse for assistance if this is your type of thing. But it's all like, you know, there's like little cute little curly cartoons of people, and then like at one point there's just this section of like, what was Egyptian fashion like, and like, oh, even in Egypt they wore cosmetics and jewelry, and there's like all these like cartoon Egyptian people, and it's just like it's all just like interspersed throughout. So you're like reading Bible verses, and then suddenly something that like Teen Cosmo, you know, and then more Bible verses, and then like Teen Cosmo, and
we gotta make it relatable. You
it's weird. It's so weird, and it's not even related. But then there's so there was a few things I found really interesting, though. And then there was this one section which says, like, is it okay to try Ouija boards or something else, or, like, or go to a psychic or something like that. And it was like, and it says, you know, absolutely, absolutely, absolutely not. No way, no ifs, ands, or buts. The Bible says playing with the supernatural is like evil and all this sort of stuff, and then it's like gives you the Bible verse that backs that up. But when you read that Bible verse, it just says, why should I commune with spirits and those who whisper to spirits or something when I have God and I can, you know, when God can give me those answers. That's what it says. And, you know, when you actually cross-reference what they're saying, look at this Bible verse. And I'm like, really? Like, it's just like, it's not even like done right. Like, the whole thing I had so many issues with. And then there's like a thing like, is it okay to try other religions? What if I believe something different than my parents? You know, just like different things like that. And it's all like saying like, no, God, it's an insult to God to even look at other options. And I mean, it's like, basically, the Bible's enough of a challenge for someone to dissect.
In the first place,
exactly. And then for you to be stuffing your politics, your interpretations, like, literally, in there. If you really believed this was the Word of God, how insulting is it to stick a thing in there saying, oh my God, back in Egypt, they had this, you know, woman wore lipstick, and, you know, like, really? Is that the Word of God? Like, at what point are you distorting your own message, right?
Well, they want, I can see right away why they have that. They want able to relate it to now and say, well, it's just the same. We're talking about the same stuff. It's not, like, a different time, and it's different, you know.
Exactly. No,
we're in Egypt, basically.
Yeah. No, I get the reason why you want that a 12-year-old American kid who has no reason to care about what Zechariah did 3,000 years ago or whatever. You want to be able to say, no, it's totally cool. It's this idea of trying to dumb down the message to make it interesting to a little kid, whereas for whatever it's worth, this Kabbalist, you know, this that we've gotten this idea of you don't even study Kabbalah till 40, whether that's actually true or not, this whole sort of thing, it's like saying a 12-year-old has no interest in these things, let alone what it means. It's, you know, you can get the kid to read it and understand certain verse, you know, or memorize a verse, but the implications of these things, like, this is an adult conversation.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I always think about that, you know, in sort of the whole, you know, phylogeny recapitulates that whole thing. I'm gonna butcher it, but, you know, human beings existed for a long time before religion, and especially before Christianity. You know, it just it wasn't there because we weren't ready for it. You know, it evolved out of necessity, and a child doesn't need the pomp and circumstance and all that shit for religion. You know, I can dig on stuff in the Ten Commandments. You know, stuff that teaches you about right and wrong. That's common to any solid religious discipline, but to indoctrinate them into the heavyweight stuff, it's no good for anybody. It doesn't work. And, you know, there shouldn't be, like, you know, Catholic grade schools. Well, they don't need the Catholic part of it. Maybe high school, maybe college, but it's just, let the child just have its childhood, you know? I think all it does is tend to have people reject it, ultimately. I mean, that's what we're seeing nowadays with the dwindling numbers. But it's...
Yeah, I think it, because the veneer of this is relevant to you because I put a little cartoon girl on it. Well, ultimately, once you grow out of little cartoon girls, do you feel like that's one more thing to put behind you? When I was a kid, I loved ponies and Jesus. Now, what is, like, you know, the song Free Fallen? She's a good girl. She's crazy about Elvis, loves Jesus and America too. And then she grows up and she wants dick, you know? she thinks all those things are behind her. I mean, I'm not trying to be an asshole. I'm saying, like, if you frame it in a childhood thing, then it's gone with childhood. And if
it becomes embedded in your whole value and judgment perceptions. So I actually feel like it does the reverse, like advertising does. Like, if you have really annoying, ridiculous advertising that you can see how bogus it is, that because you have the overall feeling that this is ridiculous, it shouldn't, you know, you feel like you have the upper hand on it, but in fact it embeds itself all the more because of the way that you treat it. You don't see it as something necessarily, like, conditioning you, but it that's like a sleight of hand thing. And so, like, even if she feels like she's grown out of it, it's still because it got her at such a young age, because there is far-reaching implications in the, I mean, your judgments change your perceptions, you know, and so you condition a child's judgments at such an earlier age. They're so malleable, they're so receptive, it just becomes, there's layers on top of it, but in the midst of those layers, there's something else operating. And so, yeah, I think it does really. You might leave your concepts of it behind on a superficial level, but because it got to you so young, it's still there. It's weird.
Hold on one sec. Sorry about that. There's this other thing. There's this other thing which I wanted to. It's interesting because I've been thinking about this the last 2 days, and I was wanted to sort of have a conversation with you guys about it. But I, on one hand, felt like I didn't know if it was actually appropriate to have that conversation here while I'm here, and on the other hand, we were supposed to be talking to Jay today. So, But just to say, what I find really interesting, there's this other book that they have, which is a book about like for young teens or preteens, like how do they go out and preach to their generation. And what I found so interesting, so I was reading this book, I found it so interesting, is that a lot of what they're seeing as the hurdle that they're dealing with is the internet and either atheists or ancient aliens.
They say that's ancient aliens?
That's what I said, yeah. Like, because there are sections where, like, okay, let's say you're talking to someone and someone says, you know, well, how do you think life, if it wasn't for God, how did life get here? And someone says, well, I think aliens, you know, came and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, oh, and where'd you find that out? On the internet? You know, it's like making fun of, like, or showing how to, like, unwrap that argument. I'm thinking it's interesting to me that they're even seeing that as a challenge to them. I mean, that's fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, how explicitly packaged it is that one can just say ancient aliens and we can all have some consensus as to what that even means.
Right.
That,
right,
like,
right.
Aliens from another part of the galaxy traveled to this area of the Milky Way and inseminated the organic Earth with a DNA-like substance that grew human beings for some sort of purpose. Like, the amount of information in a statement like that is huge. To take apart every... to even understand what DNA is, to understand a galaxy, to understand a place in the Milky Way, organic... Earth as a sort of living organism. I mean, it's just such a monumentally loaded statement, which I think speaks to what David was saying with, you know, one line of the Bible in the Old Testament, you can ponder for months if you really get into the high definition and you go to the actual language and then you break it down and then you really study it. But, you know, I guess you could have, you know, My Little Girl's Book of Ancient Aliens, and you could, I mean, I guess those, what are those, comic books? I guess we've had those for a long time.
sure, yeah.
It's, you know, this whole, I've been thinking about the whole thing of, like, the pelican, you know, or birds, how they chew up the complicated matter and spit it into the baby bird's mouth.
It's so, okay, Bill, I have to interrupt you because there's a sink. I happen, at the moment that you said that, be looking at an image in the middle of my collage that I've been working on of the Rosicrucian pelican feeding its heart to the baby pelicans. For real. It's in the center of my vision as you said that. So, go on.
And, you know, you have to trust your pelican, right? Because, A, what source material are they choosing to feed or to process? And then, you know, and then what are they spitting into your mouth? I mean, that is what that little girl's Bible book is. It says Bible, but is it the real Bible? No, this is all about processed food, you know? It's about...
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I was connecting that. You know, the whole Gurdjieff thing that I go back to about, he says, thought is as real as the matter that we digest, that you have to think of the things that you think about and that you gaze upon as a diet. And if you're gazing upon shit, then you're consuming shit and you can actually become sick. So I was always going from thought as food, but you can just do the reverse as food as thought. You know, just like you were saying, in the aisles of Walmart, there's all this processed poison. That has maybe 4% actual food, but it's already been decayed and it's just puffed up and chemicalized and it's been pre-processed, so it just goes right through your mouth. You hit a carbohydrate high or a sugar buzz or whatever, but it goes into the body and it doesn't do the intended effect. So that's what you have with all of this, all of this higher thought. It's just been broken down, chipped away, and the parents themselves don't realize that what they are chewing up and spitting into their children's mouths, the source material is bad. They're doing a good thing. Their actions are in the right intention, but they just have no idea that what they're biting off is processed food to begin with. So you're getting a processed food. You're not even, there's no organic life-sustaining material in the thing that you're giving to them. So it's a tragedy because the parents are feeling the emotional resonance of doing what they are supposed to do as parents, but they've been given poison to work with to begin with.
And it's, well, you get excited because you feel like you got the insider scoop on something, and that's the way it's presented, is that you're getting a secret. Even if you're not doing it in like the Masonic way where you're like, okay, but it's like, no, the gospel is literally the good news. So it was something that was unknown that is now known. And this is the issue with like Sync itself becoming a religion, right? Which is what Doug is concerned about, is because it can do the same thing that the gospel is doing for a lot of people. It's because you get a high off of researching it or presenting it, because you're getting you feel that you're getting the insider deal. And the feeling of being in the know is a thrilling feeling that we all want. And,
right.
You know, so you get like a cortisol hit or something every time something aligns, which is fine. I mean, this is in our nature. The ideal is just to keep things in a degree of perspective in the midst of it and realize that your particular school that's giving you that hit isn't the only place where that can come from. And also to recognize that you can say this means anything. Like, you can get that hit, and then you can, the way the mind works is you can just say, oh, this is Jesus, or this is whatever you want it to be, because whatever the correspondence is that's presented in the midst of that hit becomes associated in it. And so you look to that thing to repeat it. And so Christians tend to feel that this is the only way to get this feeling that they're getting, and they don't realize that that what's coming up for them, the excitement and the exhilaration that comes up for them, is just like a feeling that can come through all kinds of means. And that's not even the thing that's being talked about. It just gets associated with that. I'm sure that they would argue with that, understandably. But that's my feeling, is that it has nothing to do with that. It just happens to be occurring, and then you're associating. It's just the way that that works. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I think you guys are totally picking up what I'm getting. Yeah, my issue is not with someone's faith, not at all. I actually think there is something really important. There's a kernel of something that's so important and that I really respect, and at the same time, it's this weird perversion of it that I don't even know how to broach. I mean, particularly with particularly amongst family or in the situation, these sorts of situations, but on even on a wider scale, is to say, yeah, if we haven't figured out that where everything we're interacting with is sort of pre-filtered, pre-chewed, pre-packaged, we're not even at the right starting point.
Right.
It's like, how do you start dissecting these things if you're not even at the right starting point?
You should get yourself a Greek dictionary and an English Greek version of the New Testament, and just hang out with it, around those people, like in any free time that you get. Just like, I don't know how long you're going to be there, but you could just be like, I'm interested, and just let them deal with that, you know, because that shit is interesting to look at, you know, if you come at it from a scholarly angle as you're capable of, you know. I mean, how could they object to that? Like, how could they? How could anybody have a problem with you looking at something in its original text? Because then you can see that there's occurrences of double meanings or alternative meanings that are just as plausible. Like the way that the whole canon is written in the King James is just like they just chose those words, even though there's fucking 20 options per some of those words. Like, you'll go through it, and you're like, okay, it could just as easily mean that. That's what I was like with Juan Irving. I was trying to express that, like, people say the
Did you say Juan? Did you say Juan Irving?
It's Juan. It's not. Oh, it's Jan. Jan. Juan
Irving. I'm not laughing at you. I'm just, it was just funny.
It's because originally I had to call him Jan. I mean, I called
him
Jan.
Yeah, me too.
It was Jan. And then I just took it a step further and made it Juan. No offense. But that was like the thing when it was coming up with, like, he says the chosen people. I'm like, it could, because of the way that the language is, you could just as easily say the people who choose. It could be the choosing people, which, you know, that's most likely not what it means, but it could just as easily mean that. And we don't actually know. Like, there's no way to know that for sure. Just like, and it's that way throughout the whole text. You'll find so many different ways that this could just, I mean, there's only so many words in the language. It's not that, there's not that big of a vocabulary, and the same words get used for entirely different meanings, and for meanings that mean completely, literally, the opposite, because that's how the language is structured as well. You have these words that could be taken either way, you know, so, and that makes it interesting in, like, on a philosophical level, because when you're dealing with words that contain the opposites within them, you know, it leaves you something to meditate on, which is, like, my personal feeling is that was, like, intended in the structuring of the language in the first place, because people were tripping on these things in a way that we can't even really know at this point. I mean, like, but it's like, it's an artistic thing. And so the New Testament too, though, I feel like it was most likely written as a war strategy to control people. It has a lot of redeeming aspects, and one that it's a very creative text. And like, it's clever, you know, it's like, it's an intelligent text. And for that reason, it's worth some study. Whether you believe in it as it's being presented in the mainstream or not, you know. So, I just think that would be fun to pull that out. I mean, I don't know how you're interacting with these folks to just, like, actually study it in front of them, you know.
Yeah.
Or if you don't care, then you don't care. But
no, it's not that I don't care. It's a difficult if I had more time here,
right?
If I wasn't trying, you know, if my situation here was different, yeah, I think that's like I've actually have tried that in the past with mixed success. I was able with one gentleman, a friend of the family, who said something to me about Lucifer, and we were able to go and say, and I was like, well, who's Lucifer? You know, and we were able to go and look that up and say, like, you know, tell me, where do you get the idea that this is a devil, this is Satan? If he's saying he's the morning star, why does Jesus say he's the morning star? Why does, you know, just to start that conversation.
Right.
So I just dropped something into the chat here, which is a comic I did with a friend of mine a few years ago. Nearly 10 years ago. I don't know, 2003 or so. I don't know. I really don't know. But it's a game of Scrabble that's really like a religious conversation in a game of Scrabble, and So the reason I sort of bring it up is there's this one thing that makes reference in Scrabble where it says double word score. And it's the idea, you know, that a word can have two meanings. And in a game, so obviously not literally in the game of Scrabble does a word having two meanings double its point value, but sort of playing on that idea is to say, if a word has two meanings, this actually can add, not necessarily, it's obviously going to add some confusion, but it could also add some complexity, some sort of, that perhaps both meanings are true in some sense. How about if there's five ways you could take that? Perhaps all five of those are true in some sense. And then we can even take this to a conversation of just the letters having point values. It's amazing how many people play the game of Scrabble and understand that a letter has a point value. How is this?
I'm sorry. What's that? I love your comic.
Yeah, I love this thing, man.
No, you can't use God. God's a proper noun. Bullshit. John is a proper noun. George is a proper noun. God isn't. Sorry. Go on. I am listening.
Oh, so just to say, we take this to a conversation of Gematria. How is that so different from Scrabble?
Right. It's the Tower of Scrabble. That's what I've been calling that.
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, no, we played Scrabble the other night. I'm a really sore loser. I hate losing, and Amy's really fucking good at Scrabble. Like, she's been playing it, and she just kills it at Scrabble. And I want to play Bill found the Kabbalistic Scrabble, where it's all Hebrew letters, and you basically have to come up with esoteric Hebrew terminology. Although the only person I could really play it with is my rabbi, and I know he would just destroy me at it. So I need to find somebody with mediocre Hebrew to play that with.
Is that a real thing, or was that a joke? The Kabbalistic Scrabble.
Scrabala?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a joke.
Yeah, but
that's what I thought. But it's a great joke. It's a joke with truth. Yeah.
So, because you could find totally a Scrabble game in Hebrew, and then from there you just come up with you just make the rules that it's you got to use Kabbalistic terminology.
Yeah, no, it lends itself. It just it's a perfect match almost.
And I would hope that I'm saying the letter point system instead of like in our American Scrabble version, it's like the letter G is where I don't know. 2 points or something based on its sort of I think it's based on how often that those words, this would be those letters, are how common they are in words, right, is how we attribute point value for Scrabble. But you would have to give the Hebrew letters their actual point value.
Yeah, and for like the double word score or triple word score, it wouldn't be a square on the board. You'd write a word out the point value, and if you can tell the person two more words with the same point value, you can triple your score. It's just an educational kind of tool, but it would probably get pretty heavy. It's probably way more dangerous than a Ouija board.
Exactly. All right, Bill, we've taken this the direction of board or games, child's game. I want to throw this at you. Bill, you had this idea of a Rubik's Cube. My other sister-in-law, who's 16, she's playing with a Rubik's Cube. And she looked up on YouTube how to do it, like what the sort of methodology is. And she's at a point where she does a Rubik's Cube in something like 52 seconds. She Jesus. Just walks around all day long. You can shake up a Rubik's Cube and she just does it. Now, of course, she didn't figure out the trick. She learned the trick. But she made a point to me. I thought I was talking to a 16-year-old girl version of Bill Klaus. I said, well, but you didn't figure out how to do this. You looked it up online. And she said, Yeah, but I tell my friends, they can go look it up on YouTube, and they don't even bother to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's like, so yeah, okay, I'm not cheating. I looked it up. Anyone can do that. And then I bothered to learn it, because it's a process. So someone taught me the process, and I learned it.
Yeah. See, that's the thing, dude. That's what it all fucking comes down to. Because that's like all this shit about like, oh, these people with this fucking secret and they're duping the world. Yeah, and all information at this point is like, for the most part, so available. People can be hip to it if they just want to fucking look it up. It's like, yeah, she can figure out a Rubik's Cube by looking it up. It's like that totally translates on a grand scale.
Yeah, yeah.
But the thing is what reward did that 16-year-old girl envision by taking the time to do it? Was it just a burning curiosity? Was it something that speaks of the person she was or the person she is or the person she's becoming? And what did it give her, a sense of identity? Ultimately, it doesn't matter. She has this new skill, you know, and it translates to the way she can take in a large amount of confusing information and arrange it into something focused. You know, that seed is growing in her brain, and it'll serve her well down the road. But I don't think she really gets that, you know. That's something I think you understand from, you know, 15 years down the road. But when that moment arrives, it'll just be a complete aha, you know. There it is, you know. But, I mean, you talk about using the tools that you've been given, you know. There's no cheating there. Yeah, there's no... she's just, you talk about being blessed. She was blessed with the tool of the internet, and that someone out there, sort of like the Bible person going door to door, they just went to YouTube and said, this is how this is done. You know, there was a witness to the Rubik's Cube that put a video online for her to get the message, to get the good news. And she's making use of it. And I don't know, it's puzzling. I don't know. That's kind of heavy. Because I guess there's just, with the Rubik's Cube, if someone put out a video and told you this is how you do the Rubik's Cube, but it was so convoluted and so complicated, and it didn't even solve the Rubik's Cube, you would immediately reject it, because you could go to your Rubik's Cube and go, this guy doesn't know what the fuck they're talking about. But if someone gave you a rambling spiel about this is what the Bible's all about, you could go to your Bible and say, well, there it says right there, you know, he had a quote and it's in my Bible, he must be right. You know, You can tailor a Bible to the bullshit, but you can't tailor a Rubik's Cube to the bullshit. So, and if you really look at what David says about going to the original language of the Torah, it is constructed like a Rubik's Cube. It's very hard to bullshit that, because it's constructed in a way that there's really only one way to kind of, I mean, you know what I mean? That like, it's non-linear. In the sense of its number, letter, correspondence, and all the things you can do with it. But what can you do with a King James Bible? You can only kind of spread ignorance and hatred. You really can't save anybody. You can only condemn with it. It becomes a blunt object or something.
You can get people really excited. I was downtown one day, and maybe... 7 years ago, and I was super stoned. I'd smoked a bunch of hash, and there was this like intense fundamentalist guy with his Bible preaching at night, and I just like kind of walked up to this guy, and he was talking to me, and he was like, you know, I told him I was in to meditation or whatever I said to him, and he asked me if it was okay if he prays with me, and I was like, sure. And this guy grabs my forehead and just starts like shouting for Jesus to come save me and to take this boy away from meditation and other tools of the devil. And literally, I mean, this is what the guy said, and I just let him. And then I was like, okay. And when I walked away, I could just see the guy was just like, it was just like a total, like, kind of just like, let this guy have his moment. And he got such a hit from it. And I could see everything. Like, it was like his ego was just like expanded to this. He was just like super excited. He looked like he's about to come in his pants because he couldn't believe that this boy was just letting him do his thing, you know, because he needs to go out and he needs to spread the word of God. And it was really just an interesting study of just to witness that. I was like, wow, okay, have your thing, man. That's okay, nice. Entertaining.
Yeah, but you know exactly. So then, but you don't bother pointing out that him saying that you meditating is a tool of the devil or something, then what's prayer?
Right. No. It's all just so apparent. Actually, the word for prayer from the Greek, the closest translation is actually to what's the word? It means to steer someone's opinion, to change someone's mind. There's a word for that. I can't remember what it is, but basically it's that. It's to I don't know.
Persuasion?
Yeah, persuasion. To persuade. That is actually the closest translation for the Greek word for prayer. It's different with the Hebrew, but I thought I learned that in seminary school, actually. And I thought that was so funny, oh, no wonder. Because that's all you're doing when you're praying with the church, is you're trying to persuade people. And so it makes sense, especially with the rest of the New Testament and what goes on. They're persuading everybody. They're going around and they're spreading the word, but they're trying to persuade the world from their current beliefs into another belief. But like prayer, like inherently, like what a I mean to pray, like, I mean, different from like a praying mantis or like an owl, like seeking out your prey. That's a different word altogether. There's no other connection other than the way that the word sounds with that. But there is a synchronistic connection.
They're spreading their seeds, though, right? You go to seminary school to be inseminated?
Yeah, basically. And the word for testament is actually the same root as testicle. And so it's funny that there would be two, right? It's like the Old and the New Testament are like the two testicles. But I mean, there's tons of sexual symbolism throughout. I mean, people like this is the covenant is literally the circumcision, right, in the Hebrew, and so that's and then obviously you have yesod is the sex organ, and then the tip of the sex organ is malkut, and I mean, but you could take that to be like kundalini or orgon energy if you wanted to apply the tree to the chakra system, which many have done, and is a reasonable way to take it, which is like that's one way of many ways to look at it. This is what I was trying to say to Jan with when he's making the argument that okay, wisdom and understanding, you have to have wisdom and understanding before you can get to Keter and all this stuff, but it's like that's by way of ascent, which is one way to look at it. But in fact, like in a lot of the older texts, that's not even the way that's like emphasized, that it's like trying to get somewhere higher, which is like we translate it to the chakra system, we automatically take it that way. But even the chakra system was taken as a loop. It's like a journey to the head and back to the heart, you know, like in the same way that like the tree is trying to reunite these fragmented parts and bring them back together into a wholeness, not simply to like ascend a tree and get to the highest point and then rule. It's not like divide and conquer. Like that's one way to look at it, but that's not the way that is traditionally looked at. Like that's like if it was a you know, they want to take, if you want to take it as a conspiratorial system of control, like that will help your argument. But when you actually do a degree of actual research, other than like looking at like Madonna's Kabbalah, Kabbalah with a Q or a C or whatever, you know, it's like that's what you'll find there, because they're all about ascent. And like the Golden Dawn is the same way. That's all they focus on. And the way that they, like, when you look at Crowley's like path workings, like his like diaries, like it's really hard for me to take that stuff seriously, other than the fact that they're choosing to look at it this way and they can kind of like play it out. But it just reminds me so much of like Dungeons and Dragons or something. It reminds me of like a role-playing game or something, where you're just like, you're making up your parameters, and then you're just like continually enforcing them, and that gives a fantastical kind of lens, you know. But that's
speaking of role playing. I mean, you've touched on something that I maybe this is obvious, but you know, the little things I make for each episode of Always Record, those little posters, right?
Yeah.
So I made, for the Jan Urban one, I made it like a month before we did the show. I just knew that we were going to have him on. He's like, I thought of him as the mushroom guy. And I just had this like really strong image of this poster that I wanted to make. And it came out really cool, in my opinion. To me, there's elements, there's like so much sync in, it's very simple, but there's so much sync in it that I didn't even realize. One of which being that Mario's mustache perfectly aligns with the edge of the mushroom. Alice's eyes are right behind Mario's eyes. Alice wears a blue dress. Where her dress would be is behind Mario. I just sort of like put this together, and it just sort of like really spoke to me. And then afterwards was like, oh wow, you know, all these different things that I noticed that just sort of, it looked cool. And then it, I actually realized that it made so much sense. Yeah, there's a lot in there but what I realized is that after we did the show with him, I was like, well, he kind of didn't really talk about mushrooms as much as I would have liked. Maybe I shouldn't use this image. Maybe I should make a new image. And I was like, no, screw it. I really like this image. I'm going to go with it. Now, fast forward a month, right? I realized that he's not talking as the mushroom anymore. He's talking as the caterpillar. The caterpillar is the one obsessed with grammar.
Yeah.
Wow.
And it's very interesting to me. And then David, when you said you were trying to tell him that there are multiple meanings to a word, you're speaking as Humpty Dumpty, right? Humpty says, when I use a word, it means whatever I want it to mean.
Eggman.
Yeah, you're the Eggman. Right. But yeah,
the Cheshire Cat.
I think this idea of this connection between the mushroom and grammar is one that I didn't even get till just a week or so ago, when I was like, oh my god, the caterpillar sitting on the mushroom is obsessed with grammar, and here we have Jan Urban, who was the mushroom guy, and now suddenly he's just going around saying to everyone, your grammar's wrong. Your grammar's wrong, which is what the caterpillar says.
Who are you?
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. I love it.
Right. And what is the trivium? Who? Who, what, when, where, right? Who? He just keeps saying who. Who are you?
Wow.
I mean, I don't know what to do with that. I'm just telling you. It's like, I realized, like, holy shit.
Yeah. Well,
okay, go ahead.
I put that quote up from that Francis Yates book that I'm reading on the Facebook page, and talking about the grammarian pedants that Giordano Bruno comes up against when he's trying to preach this new Hermeticism, or this new philosophy of magic Kabbalah, in line with Hermetic teachings. And, you know, he goes to Oxford to give his spiel, and these people are just obsessed with the grammar, and he's trying to get them to go beyond the trivium into the quadrivium, and to just to be able to expand past that and not just get so wrapped up in the grammar. And it just seemed to align so perfectly with, you know, what we ran up against in that conversation, that, you know, I can see how you get lost in that, especially when you've tried to sort of ascend and you never got any authority to your voice, that your authority is only in the rigid rules of the trivium, that you can kind of be a taskmaster in that sector of it because you couldn't find what you were looking for beyond it, that it's a retreat, or it's a, I don't know, it's falling back into a shell of some sort. I'm kind of amazed at the explanation behind that poster and how that brought it all the way back, or fleshed that out for me, what I was kind of understanding there.
Yeah, same here. Did you actually get that book, Bill?
Yeah.
Okay, is anything you can weigh on us further than that, or?
The Francis Yates books?
Yeah.
Well, it's just, I if I read this book 5 years ago, I would have just kind of gone, I would have turned the pages, put it down, and it wouldn't have really been impacting me. But right now, I'm just seeing it so clearly, and the history is so clear, that it's sort of, it's becoming a foundation point for me. It's putting everything back into perspective. Just exactly who Giordano Bruno is. And, you know, his nickname was the Nolan. And, you know, he is a central theme in Finnegan's Wake. The Nolans, and there's a million references to the Nolan, which is Giordano Bruno.
Is this spelled the same way as, like, the Christopher Nolan?
Absolutely.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's kind of ridiculous to even speculate on it because it's it's just coiled so far right now that I just have no idea where this is going to go. But it's oh, fuck. And that's what I was going to address with Jay, because Jay has brilliant essays. I'll say this. With Jay, I equate his Kubrick theory as his time wave zero, as this sort of object of fascination that you can hold and you can pass around and look at it with wonder, because it's this solid object, you know. But what he also did is his essays on alchemy and Hermeticism are what he should be praised for, because he writes them in such a lucid language that they were really revolutionary for me. They really kind of brought a lot of things into focus for me. So I congratulate him on the curiosity factor of the Kubrick theory, because it's fun to play with. But what I'll remember him for is these alchemical papers that he wrote. And he writes a really good one on the topography of time, where he relates the hypersphere of the torus. You know, he says that's what the alchemists would base that would be the foundation of their work, you know. But scientists would use the hypercube, because scientists like straight lines. And so that's that whole kind of liberal versus conservative, you know, that whole brother battle thing, you know. You should be able to understand both. You shouldn't choose one side and try to kill the other. You should at least understand what the fighting is all about. Right. But the curious thing is what really unlocked or sent me in a very clear direction is the shape of where he basically takes the four ages of the Kali Yuga, and shows how, you know, in a hypersphere of wind, that mm-hmm. when the wind comes back around over the top to go back to the middle, when you hit the Iron Age, that's when the air starts to condense into a solid stronger than iron.
Oh, wow. See, that's the thing. So Baba Hari Das, when he expresses the how they determine the time frame of the yuga, is it had to do with how many times the average person will breathe per minute. And then they, because they look at the yuga as one enormous breath, and there's actually text that has like this extraordinary long, I was reading Alan's note there, this extraordinary long breath, but it has a number equated with how many breaths fill the big breath. And so it's all related with breath. And so what you just said with the winds makes perfect sense there. That's interesting.
Yeah, it's beautifully diagrammed. And so he relates, you know, the Iron Age as the tornado. And so it's dangerous and swirling and chaotic up at the top of the tornado, but it isn't until you get to the very tip of the tornado itself that it becomes this solid object stronger than iron that can rip through buildings and cars and metals.
We call that second part of the tornado Cyclone B.
Dangerous indeed.
You can thank Jason for that one. Jason Barrera presented that in talking about The Wizard of Oz with World War II, that wow. she gets caught up in the Cyclone B.
Yeah, that's good.
Mine.
But you see that tornado in a couple of movies that I was obsessed with that I think of the modern age are very good. The Coen brothers, at the end of A Serious Man, when he finally changes the grade in the grade book and he's made this decision that he's in stasis, you know, he doesn't know what to do, he can't make a move, and he finally makes a move. And then there's this tornado in Minnesota that, you know, so it's him entering into this Iron Age. And also, if you look at the shape of the totem in Inception, it is like this mirrored tornado.
Sure.
And, you know, what for me this is all connected to, which I think was illustrated very nicely in Joe Alexander's movie, The Dark Rift of the Soul, is this getting to the heart of what the alchemical marriage is in tracing the lineage of the Egyptian mystery schools, which led to the enlightened discourse of Hermes, you know, Trismegistus in the Hermetic Corpus, is this lineage of, what am I trying to get at? Okay, so Joe Alexander's movie, he talks about the Ba, which is the immortal part of the human being that is soul, right? Egyptian. And he connects this to Bat Man, right? Which is the Dark Knight, and which is Christopher Nolan's, you know, it's the trilogy that obsesses everybody. But there is the concept of the Ka, which is the spirit, which is the karma, right? And that the alchemical marriage is to bring the Ba and the Ka through that center point in the hypersphere, and so that they don't become divorced, that they don't separate, that you can hold that with you as you pass through that center point. And what the Christ seems to be is the first human being to have actually done that.
Well, that's the symbolism, or that's the idea, yes.
Right, and
necessarily the first, but I mean, what's interesting with that is that follows with the idea that we're only as far as any one of us can go, or that if somebody does something, that everyone is part of what they have done if they're aware of that it's been done in the first place, which I don't necessarily agree with. I agree with it on one level, but I don't agree with it in the ultimate sense.
Very Rupert Sheldrake, right? Morphogenetic fields.
I missed probably less than a minute of that, but just noticed you were talking about the sphere and the idea of pulling this through the sphere of both the ka and the ba. So obviously the kaba is a cube, right? But you notice that the only opening on it is ovular.
Right.
It's that sort of vaginal shape, that vaginal opening. But certainly this is, it sort of has a sort of torus on it. So if you were trying to, when you said the idea of pulling the ka and the ba through this sphere, I think it's interesting that the actual kaba is a cube, but the only opening, if you wanted to pull something through, it sort of starts to become spherical.
Yeah. The tefillin cube holds the scroll. You open the bottom of the container and you pull out the thing, which is a cube within a cube. So it's basically a tesseract, right? Which is, I don't know if it's a new Avengers movie, but it's sent from the tesseract. Just like it definitely is reminiscent of the Transformers thing. But then that's like the metal with the cube is also a cube within a cube. It reminds me of the wheels within the wheels of Ezekiel's vision of the seraphim. Which when I saw the first thing I thought of when you were mentioning the tornado from A Serious Man is the whirlwind that Ezekiel has to transcend in order to gain the prophecy of the seraphim. And the seraphim are described. It's obviously four fixed signs of the zodiac. You have the man, the ox, the lion, and the eagle. So you have Scorpio, Leo, Aquarius, and what was the other one I just said? Leo? Did I say Leo? Okay. Anyways, but it's like that was what seemed to be being expressed, as far as I could tell, at the end of A Serious Man, is that there's also the reality to the thing. So it's like people keep these on a story level, and it doesn't have ultimately that much depth. Like that guy is going to the rabbi and looking for all this stuff because he needs something to help him through the hard times, but he doesn't realize that what's being expressed is all very real. Like when the thing shows up, it's real, and that was like the tornado at the end. It's like these people couldn't like register what it meant for this to be a real thing. It's like they're all just playing out what they're supposed to be doing because it's tradition, but they don't realize the full depth. Not like the older rabbi apparently was gonna live forever through his Kabbalistic trickery or whatever you want to call it.
What about the fact that I would take this also from the idea that it's a tornado that takes Dorothy to Oz, right? Now, just to say, Jason Barrera sent me an email earlier this week where he was comparing something with Christopher Nolan's latest Batman movie where Catwoman, whatever, says... says there's a storm coming, right? This is like the phrase that everyone keeps repeating.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Yeah. Everyone keeps, right. So he says that he watched some TV show. I think it's called like The Tin Man, or I'd have to find the email. And he watched some TV show, and the first line of the TV show was, "There's a storm coming." He says, "Oh, of course, it's because this is the storm that takes you to Oz," right?
Mm-hmm.
So now, of course, that's Christopher Nolan. Now, something that there's a gentleman whose name is Darren. He goes on Blogger. He goes by Brizdaz. I don't know if you've seen him post, but he made a point that Anne Hathaway. He did a whole post about Anne Hathaway, that she's like this Hathor resonator. Now Hathor, of course, is the cow goddess. This is your Taurus, the other spelling of Taurus, right? Which we've all played with, and I've actually spoken to Mark LeClaire. We're all playing with this right now, this idea of the cow as the vortex. Now, So the Hathor storm, if she's the one saying the storm's coming, well, that's the cyclone, that's the tornado or the hurricane, Sandy, all these things, right? Now, so it's interesting that this idea of this Nolan, because this ties back in again, but just to say what you guys have read, what I sent you for the Suicide Kings, the idea that it would be the tornado would take you to Oz. Well, Oz means strength, and we take this to the tarot card strength, which is has a lion on it. Here's your Leo, and is also
the center of the Trump arrangement by Crowley, which is very significant.
Yeah, and I definitely see this as this card is a Kundalini rising. We could take it just because you were mentioning that. I'm just saying this is all sort of it goes. This line runs straight through the whole damn thing.
Card is actually the eye of the hurricane that is the Trumps, right?
Yeah, so, yeah.
This card came up the other day.
It's the eye of the tiger, man.
He had a friend over and and in I Heart Huckabees, the woman who is basically, she's the meaningless woman who shows up, who's like the other teacher that they don't, Lily Tomlin and Dustin Hoffman don't want Marky Mark to meet with.
The French woman. This woman
right around, at one point when she's introduced, Marky Mark goes, and that's what gives you the force.
Yes,
and
exactly.
Like, the force, and she's like, la forza, it's French for strength. And so, and then it gets repeated by Marky Mark when he catches them having sex or being together in the hotel room. Mm-hmm. And just what la force is all about.
Yes.
Force card, here you have the horror of the of Babylon, right, which is a perversion of the Shekhinah, and expressing the Shekhinah, who is in the exile, basically just being raped by everybody in order to build the great city, right? So this idea of the feminine being pushed down so that the masculine can do its thing, and it's a separation of Ze'er and Shekhinah, but the way that that's interpreted, and so it's really, when you look at that film through that lens, it becomes this whole thing that the two original detectives, they represent like the traditional Jewish mystery school and its intentions here in regard of the intersect being ultimately a positive thing. But then you have like the perversion or the, not perversion, but the alternative interpretation that everything is meaningless is like reinterpretation of the Shekhinah as this horror of Babylon. And so when you go through the story, you see that ultimately these are two fractured, overlaying philosophies that need to be reconciled.
Because
there's a truth in them both, but when they're isolated, they're not, it doesn't give you the full depth. It's like the Wizard of Oz and Dark Side of the Moon being separated, that you don't get the full depth of what's being expressed, you know.
I know you've mentioned a number of times the idea that the this idea of the European schools that are taking on the original texts and changing them, you know, like your Rosicrucians, your Golden Dawn, all this sort of stuff, right? Do you see that her role in that movie, particularly that she's French, would further identify her as the European tradition?
And so you have, I mean, the Statue of Liberty was a gift from the French. And I just saw, who was it? It was Cosmic Comics or one of these guys put up a image of the Statue of Liberty in like every fucking disaster film, like, and saying, well, if there's ever a apocalyptic thing going down, stay the fuck away from the Statue of Liberty. Water. And then idea of the Statue of Liberty, if you take that as the, I mean, I know it has a masculine face, but it seems to express this, the woman who is the liberty, which is the freedom, which would be the receptivity of the Shekhinah, and then of course it repeatedly gets immersed in water or ice or something, you know, like, so, I don't know.
I want to back up 1 second, just because when you compared this to the Shekhinah, the idea that the pillar of cloud, right, is another take on the Shekhinah. So the idea that this vortex, again, the spinning pillar of cloud, when right. You see Dorothy going to Oz in this tornado, is that not a pillar of cloud?
Right. Yeah. You could take this on multiple levels, as like you're mentioning the ox, and you have the llamid is taken by the European occultists, but you can see the shape of the llamid is actually a serpent, whereas the tet is literally a serpent, which is strength, is a serpent.
Yes,
Llamid is also a serpent. It's one of the other serpent letters. I believe the other one is shin. Shin can be pronounced either like s or sh, right? But the s is definitely a hiss, right? But llamid is the directing, it's the ox, I know I'm pronouncing this wrong, but goad or goad, it's the what you direct the ox with. It's like basically you hit the ox with it. The serpent itself associated with the whirl of the tornado. So gonad, yeah, totally. but it's the directive force of the ox, and the ox itself is the life breath. And so you could look at this tornado as like the force that directs the life breath, because the breath is like this whirling tornado, right? So does that make any sense? I mean, you could take it as mind control in terms of like the storm is coming. It's something that directs you, like it directed Dorothy to Oz, and in a sense it's like everybody turning in their paper currency for gold. It's like that total mind control. How the fuck did that happen? You know, it was done out of fear or whatever, but I mean, a storm, like a very fear-evoking thing, and people are most easily manipulated in a place of fear. I mean,
real quick.
Oh, go ahead. Go ahead, Bill. Go ahead, Bill. Yeah.
You know, the storm for me is that, you know, one of the key elements of being raised Catholic that is the first clue that things are not, may not be what they seem, is, you know, that the idea if someone was born but they didn't have access to the church and the sacraments of the church, that they would not go to heaven. And it's like, well, where do they go? It's not their fault. It's like, oh, they don't go to hell, but they go to someplace, limbo. You know what I mean? Like an unbaptized baby. That, and it just, it doesn't make sense that if you were just unlucky to be born in the wrong part of the world, you just pull that thread and then you're off. You know, you're off trying to solve that mystery, and that's, you end up like me. But
I've been there.
But right now, with what the World Wide Web is, and how much information is out there, you know, it's everywhere all the time, and there's really no excuse.
Wait. You know, actually, this is a fascinating thing, because there are areas of the world that have very poor internet access. Is that, because what I always thought, you said about the unborn babies, what I always thought about is when they said, if Jesus says the only way to heaven is through him, so he appears in this one area, tells all these people, and then goes away. And it's like, what if you're a pygmy in the Australian outback? Are you just screwed? So for generations and generations and generations, all your people, no matter what they do, they're going to hell because they never met Jesus? And is that fair that he didn't show up there? To me, that seems like the flaw in the equation there. It's like that's a very unjust God in that scenario. But if you're comparing the internet now, I have to consider the fact that that pygmy has no more internet access than he has Jesus access.
Well, no, absolutely. No, I agree. I guess, what am I trying to say here? It's that we've leveled up, right?
Yeah.
The book transformed into the internet. So, and the glory being in that leveling up is that you have every version of a book. So you're not stuck with just a King James version. You've got the King James, you've got the other one, and then you've got the original text that are, you can go as far as your own curiosity, you know. Anyways.
Sorry, I didn't mean
that. No, I thought I saw something that I wanted to get to here, but I'm losing it. The fact that this storm is coming, right, is that most of us here in America have access to the internet. We have access to ask questions. If we're puzzled about something, we know there's always a resource that we can go to ask for more information. You know, we don't have to...
See, but a lot of times in big storms, the electricity goes out and then...
So I had this sync thread that I followed. Like, one of my earliest things when I was first started sync blogging was just, hey, here's a pattern I'm noticing, and then trying to develop what does that pattern mean, right? And I had this thing, which I think it's my second blog post, and it's a thread that I every now and then comes up, but it comes up strong, is I called it smoke signals. And it was the idea that it was always related to communication, and I saw that it could go one way or the other, that at first I thought it was the shutdown of the internet, and then I realized, well, actually a smoke signal is what you use to send a message. It's a primitive method of sending a message. So there was definitely this weird correspondence between the smoky, cloudy thing, these syncs that I was getting, and information. Now, of course, we have cloud computing, right? So there's this idea of you're sending a message through the cloud is a smoke signal. But of course, smoke can obscure a message. It can hide something. So we have this weird interplay of, like, the polarity. But what you're saying of this storm and trying to get a message through is probably one of the earliest and an oddly persistent thread in what I've been paying attention to.
So I was thinking about smoke signals last night when we watched a film called Seven Psychopaths, which just came out with Sam Rockwell and Woody from Woody Harrelson. Anyways, there is this thing that I noticed, and I don't completely know what it means. But we watched Avengers, and then we watched that. And there's a scene where Bruce Banner, who's the Hulk, right, had fallen into a building in Avengers, and he gets approached by Harry Dean Stanton, who was in Repo Man, and he's like inquiring into he's got clothes for him, and he's like, I don't remember the exact scene, but he mentions aliens. He's talking about aliens coming from the sky, and it was just really obscure. Like, they put this actor in there for like fucking, I don't know, less than a minute or something. I'm like, oh wow, there's Harry Dean Stanton. But he is in this other film for about the same amount of time, Seven Psychopaths, which has the same actor. I can't remember his name, but the guy who played the Hulk shows up in this other movie, and he gets killed. But Harry Dean, where I'm like, oh, it's those two guys together, like, for us, two nights in a row. But I thought it was interesting because Repo Man centers around aliens. I mean, the Malibu that they're looking for has the aliens in it, the trunk or whatever it is. And I don't know. I don't know where I was going with that. But I was thinking about smoke signals because in Seven Psychopaths, what's his name? I can't remember. Sam Rockwell shoots a flare gun up into the sky to signal them. If you guys have seen the film,
Yeah.
Okay. So you remember when he shoots the flare gun in order to get the attention? That was the thing that said the guy didn't have the gun, but he did have a flare gun.
Yeah.
I'm only mentioning it because, I mean, you mentioned smoke signals in here. That was the first thing I thought of. I was like, oh, yeah, that's how it's a form of communication that people used to have to do in long distances and stuff. Anyways, it's also.
Well, it's funny, when you said Seven Psychopaths, I was automatically thought about, like, chakras and, you know, and the seven veils and all that sort of stuff. And then the fact that you said it ended with him shooting this fiery thing up into the sky, what is that?
There's a super deep sync with Tom Waits in that film, who carries a white cap around. And then when they first walk up, and he's just like, oh, you've just been waiting here. And obviously he's Tom Waits.
Right.
A little subtle joke, but the white cap relating Tom Waits with Dr. Parnassus, and how we were repeatedly at least I know I was. I don't remember how far we went with that, but that what's the guy? My brain right now. The guy from fucking Batman who was the Joker, Heath Ledger, were equating him with.
Oh my God! Wait, I'm sorry. I just got it. The White Rabbit has the watch, right? He's always looking at his watch, and he says, "I'm late. I'm late. I'm late." Yes. In Parnassus, you know what Tom Waits' name is? Nick, like as in Nick of Time, in the nick of time.
Yeah, he's always there in the nick of time. And then you have Down Under, right? And the same day, did you guys see an interview with Tom Waits where you totally can see that Heath Ledger is like imitating him?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Same fucking thing as the Joker. And so those took place in Australia the day that Heath Ledger was born. Was that it? And Tom was like way younger. It's like his birthday. There was some level to it. I got to look it up again. But I think that was what it was. It was like, what the fuck? He did this interview on his birthday and he's like talking. And like Tom Waits doesn't always talk like that, but he talked like that in that interview. It's so fucking weird.
That's why I mean, I've been a Tom Waits fan for a really long, like it's one of the few artists I've ever been like obsessed with. Like my Tom Waits obsession runs pretty deep. And when everyone was saying that that he had to be imitating him, I don't know, because he doesn't always sound like that. He has these periods where he has a sort of sound to him, even in his speaking voice.
That degree in that way, except for
I know, I know. It's. I'm really on the fence about that one because it's true. It's eerily similar. No, but I also
under, and it's like Alice's Adventure Underground. That's just like I don't know. I guess
what I'm saying, I'm on the fence. Is it intentional? Did Heath Ledger actually see that interview?
No, I don't think so.
I don't think so.
Canny. That it's like it feels like it could be.
Yeah.
Well, Tom Waits is a character that is Tom Waits' birth name.
Tom Allen Waits, actually.
I mean, he's playing a character.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it's very apparent in very very early live shows that you know it seemed very late 70s, kind of that Richard Pryor Mudbone thing. Or whenever Robin Williams would go into the old wise man bit, you know, it just seemed along that line, you know, that, you know, Tom Waits was tapping into that kind of timeless character, but, you know, he just lived it, you know? So Tom Waits is playing a character. So for Heath Ledger to be playing Tom Waits, it would be simple to think of Heath Ledger playing what Tom Waits is. Maybe Heath Ledger is tapping into that same, the spirit of what Tom Waits was tapping into.
Mm.
Is that the more enlightened way to think of that, or?
Very hard to say, because the fact is that in Parnassus, the fact is Tom Waits is in it, so he might have met Tom Waits, they might have gotten to talking. I mean, there is a chance for direct influence.
Sure.
Particularly since the Batman movie and the Parnassus movie are filmed around the same time. So even if he had never heard of Tom Waits, he met him around that time.
Yeah. You know, so that whole Ba is the soul, Ka is the spirit. So Ka could be character, you know, that when, if you are not prepared for the death and rebirth process, your Ba passes through. What remains are these ghosts or this residue of your ka, of your karma, which is embedded in the people that you've interacted with, the choices you've made, the things you've done. The whole point is that maybe an ascetic lifestyle limits the amount of interaction you have so that you have a better handle on bringing that ka with you as the ba passes through. So, you know, with Heath Ledger, did Heath Ledger absorb Tom Waits' character for him?
You know, they're playing all throughout that with the Egyptian symbolism. And it's funny because when you say the Ka and Ba thing, the as much as I should be more, I should have other sources, but my closest source for knowing what you're talking about is actually The Road to the Western Lands by William S. Burroughs, where that's my favorite Burroughs book. As weird as his stuff is, I can't believe I've read as much by him, but that's my favorite. And much of that is just extreme focus on Egyptian mysticism. But the fact that they're playing with Egyptian mysticism to the degree that they were, and here you have the Western land, is what is referred to as the underworld, right? And so right away, there's this connection. I mean, you can see, like, it's not actually Heath Ledger, it's when the other actors portraying him. I don't remember which one it was. I know it wasn't Johnny Depp or Jude Law. The other guy is in the boat, and then they approach Tom Waits, and he goes, "What's up?" And it's the boat actually has Anubis on the head of it. It's very Egyptian. And then he sees the dead cow in the water, and then everything turns into crazy hellishness. I don't know. It's just like that's. It's just so perfect. The "What's up, Doc?" with the rabbit reference to Bugs Bunny, and then obviously, you know, in the film is Tony. Heath Ledger's name in the film is Tony, and so it's just really classic that Tony in The Shining is nicknamed Doc. I talk about this in my chapter. Actually, it's like one of my favorite little sinks, but it was very reinforced once again watching Seven Psychopaths, and here he has fucking white rabbit. It's just all too perfect there.
There's an episode of The Sopranos where I think it's the end of the episode, but there is a snippet of William S. Burroughs talking, and he's naming the Egyptian gods of the underworld.
Tony Soprano?
Yeah. Because Tony Soprano is an individual who should have everything. I mean, he eats what
Wait,
he wants.
Say this again. In The Sopranos, Tony Soprano is naming off the Egyptian gods?
No, it's at the end of the episode, and they're playing a snippet of William S. Burroughs. He's reciting something, but he's saying the names of the Egyptian gods
and Tony,
of the underworld.
And is Tony watching it? Like, or is this like during the credits?
It's during
or
the credits.
Okay.
But it speaks to the levels that David Chase, you know, does with that show.
Had a rhythm. It had like it was set to a beat.
I think so. I'm pretty sure.
Psy did. There's an album that's The Road to the Western Lands, but all that recording of him talking about the Egyptian gods is The Road to the Western Lands, which is like, I mean, totally like Your Spirit Lies on the Whispering Wind. The West in that song. What is it? In Stairway to Heaven.
Yeah.
Yaakov's stairway. It's what does he say about the West? He goes, "I should know this."
Your stairway lies on the whispering wind, or
as that says the West. As I look to the West, my spirit cries for leaving. So his spirit came from the West, is what he's saying, which is a reference most likely to the Western lands, which is what that's the Egyptian term for the underworld.
Oh, it's wow. Because they have a three-disc set called How the West Was Won that Zeppelin released with a lot of live recordings.
Why? And that's also why Jim Morrison says the West is the best, ride the highway. No question that that's what he's talking about. And actually, if you listen very closely, in the end, he shouts out Duat.
Really?
Absolutely. And you'll never see it in the lyrics because it just sounds like he's just screaming. But he says duet very clearly.
It could be misinterpreted as that, possibly?
Well, it doesn't say duet. Maybe it does in some lyrics places, but I mean, he's doing his thing.
Just duet.
Yeah, just duet. Duet for Underworld. For our listeners.
So we could of course see Tony Soprano as some sort of like he is in a way, the harbinger of the underworld, right? You actually call, we used to call these mafia people, like, the king of the, criminal underworld or something.
Yeah,
like, there's
yeah.
There's a phrase, like an old school sort of phrase of, like, the, like, that criminal underworld type thing. And then, of course, the mafia boss is always the sort of king of that. So that places him very neatly as a sort of Osiris or something like that.
Sure. I look at the underworld, too, as simply, like, as Terrence McKenna would say, the wiring under the board.
Yeah.
That's how what sleight of hand is. And, of course, like, we look at the like magic. Like, I see whether conscious or unconscious or whatever, the scale of, like, particularly the Heath Ledger related synchronicity. It's like that, like, the darkest, weirdest, like, sleight of hand magic. I feel like I got tricked or something. Like, the whole pronoun, the level. Parnassus feel very much like a sleight of hand magic show that just, like, it's like, what was its purpose? What did that just do? It, like, it did something, you know, or it set something in motion, or it played with some under the board wiring, you know.
Absolutely. That movie fascinates me. And this seems to be, was also, in a strange sort of way, was the breakthrough for Tom Waits. I mean, having followed him for so many years and no one knew who he was, or very few people knew who he was, and it seemed like it was after that movie that suddenly everyone knew who Tom Waits was. And in that strange sort of, I don't know, I don't really mean this as ritual, but in the sort of, like, ritualistic high-profile death of Heath Ledger, which, of course, then... how many people do you think would have seen Dr. Parnassus if it weren't for Heath Ledger's high-profile death? Do you know what I mean?
I don't know. Not that many people watch, like, Tideland or any of the other... they watch Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, but... what's his name? I'm spacing.
They only watch Fear and Loathing because of Johnny Depp, though.
Right, but I mean, Terry Gilliam, true. I mean, but, you know, Terry Gilliam is a weird fucking director, but I like how, okay, in tying this back around, I like how Terry Gilliam in Fear and Loathing has the whole, this must be in the Hunter S. Thompson book, but how the lawyer wants to listen to White Rabbit. It's like, White Rabbit, back the tape on. He wants to die listening to White Rabbit in the bathtub.
Bring it back to Tom Waits in the watery, with the bathtub. Again, this is the bathtub where the king goes to die.
Yeah, totally. And then that, it's like the bathtub of where the Anubis boat is. I mean, he's in the water where he sees the floating cow, you know, Heath Ledger's character. And he says, "What's up, Doc?" Another rabbit reference. I don't know. I like
the bathtub.
Alcott's thing, just to emphasize the significance of this, is that Lepus, the constellation Lepus, is the boat that Anubis rides through the underworld, which is the rat. So the boat of Anubis is the rat. And also you have who's the hunter? I'm spacing right now. The constellation that stands between
Orion or Osiris. Yeah, same.
Osiris is there next to Sirius, next to Lepus. So they're all in a row.
Absolutely. The Hunter S. Thompson. So right, exactly. So the hunter with the it's the hunter and his dog are the things chasing the rabbit. So right. The hunter goes down the rabbit hole,
which is why he's always running. He's late for an important date because he's running away from the Sirius dog. Right.
Hunter now, Tom Waits' son.
In the understanding of the underworld, how do you both relate the underworld to the astral dimension?
Well, so below, that's the meaning. The constellations are the underworld. So because they're what's directing us. So this is really interesting. Because you had mentioned, Bill, the vision and the voice, that you had gotten that copy of it, mm-hmm. I was thinking about looking at the vision and the voice again, but I decided instead, at least initially, to make a request of my rabbi to go through with again. And we just read the chapter in Seraphim, and this, when he pierced.
Hold on, real quick. You've broken up terribly over the last minute.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I missed like 90% of that last like 30 seconds.
Same here.
Oh shoot! Can you hear me now?
I can hear you now. Let me hang up on you real quick, and I'll call you right back. One second.
Dave's not here.
Are we here? Alan?
Yeah. All right. Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, I sound better now?
Yeah. So you were saying you were going to look at the vision and the voice, but before you did, you handed the copy to your rabbi?
No. I had requested of my rabbi that we go through the book of Ezekiel.
Okay.
Because that's where that came from. I mean, their whole approach to it is based off of Ezekiel. And so I wanted to look at the actual Hebrew. And so we read the first chapter of Ezekiel together in the last 3 weeks or 2 weeks or whatever it's been. That was like a that's been coming up a whole hell of a lot. Is that you're looking at astrology, but the way that the wheels are expressed, that the wheels have eyes. So the wheels of the seraphim all move together just like the constellations, but they emphasize the earth. The connection of the earth to the seraphim is connected through wheels that expand into space. And that these wheels have eyes. And so I was realizing that when you're looking at this through the lens of the zodiac, which is obviously what it's referring to, when you look at the zodiac, it's always represented as a wheel. So if you have a natal chart, it's represented as a wheel, and then each sign has its opposite. And when you're understanding a natal chart, you take that into account. Like, the astrologers who I've met who are serious about it really actually emphasize that. So, like, I'm a Sagittarius, so my opposite would be Gemini. And so there's you use those correspondences in order to determine information. And so it's all through correspondence. And those correspondences are held together through the archetypes. And this is an archetypal medium of expression. And so I just found that really kind of, like, interesting and applicable to all these things, because that's like one explanation for the way that these things play out, especially when I'm considering that this is also in other people would refer to this as the underworld. So what they're taking as the above and we're below, you could take that as we're above and it's below, because it is the wiring under our board, not through determinism, but through influence. And when we read the commentary on the Zohar by Ramak, he always emphasizes, or he has emphasized, this idea of stressing the difference between something being determined and something being influenced, which is why, like, I, wow. You know, yeah, it's like that's a big point that he's wants people to understand, that, like, what influence means. Like, if you're being influenced, you're not being mind controlled, you're being steered. And so to look at astrology and emphasize influence is, like, huge. It's not like this is a fortune telling. It's not like this is what's going to happen to you. It's just that this is the way that things left to their own devices will play out. Like, it's a type of inertia or something. So
I like that a lot.
Yeah, you need it like a directional force in the midst. And that's what spiritual practice emphasizes, is gaining mastery over choosing your own destiny, basically. And even though things play out by a certain set of dynamics because we exist within a vacuum that has dynamics to the way that it collapses upon itself and redistributes itself. The way that we can change that is through an awareness of those dynamics, which means those archetypes. And so that's why it's helpful to have some knowledge of these things. That if they're secret, it's mainly because people tend to destroy what they don't understand. People have had that tendency,